You keep passing it, you keep passing it, and I'll do that tomorrow, I'll do that tomorrow. You keep saying that, then you're not going to achieve that type of ma'rifah. And that type of person is called into this hadith, فَمَنْ وَمَنْ قَصَّرَ عَنْ مَعْرِفَةِ ذَلِكَ فَهُوَ شَاكٌ مُرْتَابٌ. This person is reluctant, and his iman, his faith, his heart, his intellect is doubtful. Until the day you are reluctant, you are doubtful in the ma'rifat of imam, you are doubtful in the ma'rifat of knowing your imam, understanding the or comprehending the values of your imam, your nabi, your kitab, your book, your Allah, then you are in trouble. So ma'rifat of imam is the source of all knowledge. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
You just listened to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Ammar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. Israeli genocide in Gaza has been described as a living hell on earth, with a deafening Western silence regarding the Israeli genocide of Gazans and active U.S. arms supply deals that contribute to the murder of more civilians, like the sons of Hamas Political Bureau Chief Ismail Haniyeh. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the duplicitous role that the U.S. is playing, the losses of IOF regime forces, and how Israel continues to dodge the ceasefire deal with excuses with the intent to prolong the aggression. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Hossein Abu-Khaiti is an activist and political commentator joining us from Sana'a. Also joining us is Sakina Datouf, journalist, author, and producer from London. Welcome to you both. I'll start with you first, Hossein Abu-Khaiti. And I'd like to get your thoughts on what the U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has said, where he said the U.S. does not have any evidence of Israel committing a genocide in Gaza. He told that to a Senate committee just this past Tuesday. Just before that, matter of days before that, he admitted that 25,000 women and children have actually been killed, of which 14,000 of them are children, which means every hour four children have been killed. How could he say that? Admit to that, but say that a genocide is not taking place.
I mean, we don't know what does genocide means in the United States. I mean, genocide means is exactly what's happening in Gaza. I mean, hundreds of thousands of civilians has been killed or injured. An entire city has been flattened. I mean, the entire world population have gone in their millions to the street condemning the Israeli genocide. The United Nations has called for stopping this genocide. Amnesty International, Oxfam, and Human Rights Watch have condemned the Israeli attack and killing of civilians, especially children. More than 16,000 children have been killed. I mean, the United States actually, because it's the one that's actually supplying all the weapons, all type of weapons, to the United States, as the Secretary of Defense has admitted about a month ago or more than a month, when he said, admit that 25,000 civilians has been killed, most of them children, and he said that they have supplied Israel with more than 25,000 guided bombs. So those weapons actually, and the help of the United States, If it was not given to the Israeli regime, they will not be able to conduct a war against the Palestinian people for more than a month. But why the United States is saying so, and this is not a genocide? Because if they say this is a genocide, this means that they are condemning themselves, because they are really and directly involved in this war against the Palestinian people. And as well, on the top of that, they have tried and they are actually have attacked Yemen dozens of times to stop Yemeni blockade, which has actually not allowed any Israeli ship to go to any ports of the occupied Palestine. So United States crimes has been done throughout the existence of the United States. We've seen what they done in Vietnam, in Afghanistan, and all around the world, and as well in Iraq with this lie about chemical weapons. Just imagine, millions of Iraqis has been killed or injured, millions has been displaced. But what happened at the end? They couldn't find any proof of those weapons in Iraq. But has anyone actually brought to court? Has anyone even apologized of what had happened? But what the United States actually is doing, they will wait maybe for 50 years, and they will actually say that that they were wrong, and they will apologize exactly what happened when they have thrown a nuclear bomb in Hiroshima and in Nagasaki during World War II. They only admitted their mistake and as well apologized for those nuclear attacks only during Obama when he was in office. So United States, all Arab nations actually should actually stand with the Palestinian, because what's happening now, it shows how Israeli is really, really weak. And if the Palestinian people, and they will, I believe they will continue with attack from Yemen and all the resistance with forming blockade against Israel in any area, any Muslim country can do, I believe that Israeli existence will start to vanish.
Yeah, well, Sakina, too, our guest there is from Yemen, and we shouldn't be that surprised, in a sense, where we look at the nine-year-old war that was executed on Yemen by Saudi Arabia and its allies, with the majority of the weapons dropped there to be U.S. weapons, which killed many children. That war, I believe, had 400,000-plus casualties. And we're seeing a genocide unfold in the Gaza Strip, again, with U.S. weapons. What type of role is the U.S. playing in this genocide? On the outside, they show concern and compassion for the civilians that are getting murdered. But we know that they are approving these military sales, and some say it appears to be every other day that a license is granted for delivery of these arms to the Israeli regime.
The reality is America cannot do anything else. The U.S. is complicit 100% in the genocide that's going on right now in Gaza, but also in the wars that have happened in the past in the region, including Yemen. So, it is obvious that, because these are America's wars, that they are having other countries fight for them. So they cannot say anything else. We really cannot expect anything else from them. However, the evidence is out there. What has really changed at the moment with the war in Gaza is that they used to be able to control the narrative before. And, when they said things like showed false compassion or talked about, feeling sorry for things that were not good, people bought into the story. What happens now is now everything is being laid out and nobody believes what they say anymore. However, they have to keep this up, because now and then they are hoping that people will forget, that there will be a lapse of understanding, and in between they will keep on plugging, reminding people that, oh, it's not a genocide, these things happen in a war. But right now, whatever they do, I think, is not holding any water. The genocide is obvious. The world is watching it live. The pictures that we are seeing, the atrocities that we are witnessing, I think they are really, it is going against them when they make statements such as this, saying it's not a genocide. It is them who are becoming the laughing stock of the world when they keep denying what is obvious.
Hassan Abukhaiti, on a military perspective, there was a recent report, there's many reports that have come out. One of them is compiled by Israel itself and Israeli officials, where veteran combat officers have cited the fact that from a military perspective, Israel is losing. And basically it's saying, first of all, that in the best case scenario, Hamas cannot be defeated until the year 2026 or 2027. An interesting development was the fact that the Israeli military announced the withdrawal from its regime forces in the southern Gaza Strip, in Khan Yunis, of which many took that as a sign of perhaps Israeli regime forces being defeated. We also know that a few hundred Israeli regime forces have been killed. Why is it that they are still continuing with a genocidal war where they're losing and not coming to the negotiating table and to come up with to agree to a ceasefire?
I mean, the reason behind that, at the beginning, that they thought that this war on Gaza will take only a matter of weeks, and they thought that it will force Hamas either to surrender or to let the prisoners, the Israeli people that and military in the hand of Hamas. But what happened was actually the opposite. We are now are entering the 7th month of this war, but the thing behind their failure and their insistence to continue even though they failed is because what happened in 7 October has actually hit Israeli regime really hard, because the existence of Israel was about that is a safe country for all Jewish people from around the world, from any country, any Jewish can come to Israel. He will be given a Palestinian land, a Palestinian house. He will be given a support from the Israeli regime. But what happened, there are hundreds of thousands of Israeli around Gaza have fled their cities, have fled all area around Gaza, and as well in the north of Palestine, after Hezbollah started attacking in support of the Palestinian people, hundreds of thousands as well has gone under the ground or have left those cities and villages. And what has actually added more pressure on Israel is the blockade that was formed by Yemen, and as well the attack on Eilat, which have stopped that port. And as well, they thought that only Eilat city was one of the last of the safe place in Israel, but actually it was the opposite, because Yemeni have targeted those area. So this actually 7 October has made Israel is not safe. And there are reports that there are tens of thousands of Jews in Israel have left, because they can go to any country because they have another nationality. That's why Israel actually is trying to continue, because they think they might break Hamas. They think they might force other Arab country to help them or stopping aid from coming to Gaza. Okay. And actually is totally the opposite, and the Palestinian people and the Palestinian resistance is still attacking and continue attacking Israel from the beginning of those attacks.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Taking a look at a motion that has been put forward to the UN, it's Palestine's membership seeking to review the Palestinian Authority's application of a full member state for Palestine. Now, we know that has happened before, but the biggest obstacle that stands in that is the U.S. and its veto. The U.S. is insisting on the fact that there needs to be a negotiated solution with Palestine and the Palestinian Authority before the application should be processed. Why does the U.S. insist on that? Why can't Palestine become a UN member and then for negotiations to take place, you think?
I think it's because they have to ensure that whatever negotiations happen, they have control of the Palestinian Authority. So whoever is going to lead Palestine should be their puppets and should really be speaking for them, and then admit Palestine if they were to. Because at the moment, they are not sure who is going to be leading the process. And obviously, that it doesn't go in their interest, and they will not support it. They will keep vetoing it, unless in the same way that they have put their puppet governments in other parts of the Middle East. That's basically what they are waiting for. The moment they can control people in authority in Palestine, that's when they probably will stop vetoing and allowing Palestine to be part of the UN.
Taking a look at the defeat that Israel is facing, Hossein Abu Khaiti, on the ground there in the Gaza Strip. We also know that it is involved in military skirmishes with Hezbollah when it comes to the southern part of Lebanon and the northern part of occupied Palestine. We also know that the Islamic Resistance of Iraq is targeting Israel quite often. Actually, in the past 2 weeks, it has increased its attacks on the occupied Palestine and the Israeli regime. And of course, we now look at another front, possibly, with Israel attacking the Iranian consulate in Syria, where Iran has vowed retaliation. Many say that Israel can't be extended on so many fronts. What do you think? Do you think that Israel is going to be able to handle all of these military engagements on so many different areas?
I mean, I know that they will not be able. I mean, they couldn't even handle the resistance in Gaza. They only use carbot bombing, and even though this area is still having much resistance and much attack against Israel by launching missiles from those areas that was carbot bombed. But of course, I believe that this is actually the first step for the defeat of Israel, because they don't know what to do. And they think they want actually to show that they still have the power when they target the Iranian embassy, or when they target area in Lebanon, and they are sending threat all around them that they will continue in Gaza, because they are weak and they don't want to lose that. And but I believe that Iranian response, it will be soon, because what the Israeli did is a kind of attack against Iran. But of course, this is the decision is in the hand of the Iranian government, and they are actually the one who really knows how to deal with the Zionist state. But I believe if Israel could be defeated in a matter of month, of all Arab countries will cut ties with them. I mean, just imagine, Yemeni army have formed a blockade in the Red Sea, and what Israeli regime has done with the United Arab Emirates, they are allowing ship to go to United Arab Emirates, and then all the goods or what is needed to Israel is going all through United Arab Emirates, Saudi, and Jordan. This shows actually that Yemeni blockade is successful, but as well shows that the Israeli actually, they are depend their lifeline is in country around them. And I believe if Turkey as well will cut all its ties, I believe at that point Israeli will be so weak. And if they know that they could actually handle all those countries, I mean, we have seen they didn't actually, they were sending threat to Hezbollah. If Hezbollah will continue attack, they will might invade, they will might, bomb the entire country. But what they did, actually, they only a small response against Hezbollah, because they know if they actually cross the red line that was actually set by Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, they know that Hezbollah attack will not be only to respond against Israel, but actually it will be the start of the liberation of occupied Palestine.
We need to talk about the ceasefire talks, Sakina, that too. And it's very interesting. One of the sad developments of this past day was that on Eid al-Fitr, you had the assassination of three of the sons of Ismail Haniyeh, political bureau chief of Hamas. And he came out and he said, even though that's happened, my sons were there. It's not going to stop us from not pursuing the ceasefire talks, where at this point, I'm not even sure where it stands, because we're having Israel not being sincere in wanting for that to happen. What do you think is preventing Israel from, coming out with a solution, or agreeing to the solutions that are put forward, the provisions that have been put forward by Hamas? It seems like they want this to drag out. That's one assessment being made here.
I think there are two different things. I think number one, it is Netanyahu himself who definitely wants to drag this because his political career depends on this, and he knows that when the war comes to an end, you know, he's got a lot of charges to answer to. So in his own personal interest to ensure that this war continues and goes on, because that's his survival. So that's, there is one aspect of that. But the other aspect of Israel in general, I mean, if they were to accept a ceasefire right now, what are they going to say to their people and to the world? What have they achieved from killing that many people, from committing a genocide? There isn't even one success story that they can give to their own people. So they have not achieved anything. And I think the reason why they are delaying is in the hope that they might just be able to do few things, like, for example, assassinate the sons of the leader of Hamas and then claim that they have achieved something. I think it's a struggle. It's like a wounded animal. Israel right now is just literally hitting everywhere because they just don't know where to go. It's like someone gone crazy and gone mad, and dealing with these kind of people is atrocious because you just don't know. And I think at the moment there is also the factor of Iran. I mean, here in the West, in the UK, there are so many speculations, but what that reveals is the fear that exists about what Iran is now going to do and how they're going to retaliate after the strike. And I think even if Israel, for them moving away from Gaza, southern Gaza at the moment, is because they are expecting some kind of a retaliation. And you can see the fear. I mean, Israel at the moment really has lost everything, all sorts of military, psychological, all sorts of warfare. And I think they are not going to accept a ceasefire because they have nothing to show for what they've done.
Indeed. Well, maybe you can help us, Hossein El-Bukhaiti, figure out what the U.S. President Joe Biden is, what is his approach is. I mean, it's quite perplexing. You know, he comes out and he criticizes, at least that's what the reports say, criticizes Netanyahu. He says Israel's approach is a mistake. And I'm going to quote him. He urged Netanyahu, quote, to just call for a ceasefire, allow for the next 6-8 weeks total access to all food and medicine going into occupied Palestine. But he's the one that's providing Israel with military arms. So what is the U.S. stance here? Can you maybe clarify that for us if you can?
This statement, or as you said, criticism from Biden to Netanyahu, just for the use for the media, like they want to show that they are angry with what the Israeli is doing. And it's actually a clear proof that they know exactly what's happening, and that is what's happening is a genocide. But on the other hand, when he asked Netanyahu or requesting for a ceasefire for 6 months, it's the United States who's actually blocking by vetoed many resolutions from the from the Security Council. I mean, if he really wants a ceasefire before calling up to Netanyahu, he should actually stop vetoing any call for ceasefire, stop the supplies of weapons. But as well, when he's calling for ceasefire, you see that they are as well requesting the Palestinian resistance to release all of the prisoner of war. But he has not request from Israel to actually release the hostage that they have been taken from Palestine. And it's not actually the war against Gaza. It's not about 7th of October. It's not about the existence of Hamas in Gaza. Hamas was actually elected. We see what's happening in the West Bank. The authority was recognized there by the United Nations, by the United States, and as well UN Security Council, and as well by Israel. And they have recognized Israel. And what's happening actually there? There is no Hamas. Israel has been actually taking lands, has been killing people, has been taking hostages, for many, many years. So United States as well now is actually close to the election. That's why I believe that Biden actually will do whatever it takes to help Israel, and I believe he will increase his help to Israel, because we know that the lobbyist in the United States is controlled by the Zionist state. That's why I didn't see any resolution, only by the resistance to continue their attack. And as well, I believe if Yemeni will extend their attack to target those Israeli ships in the Persian Gulf to stop them from delivering goods to Dubai and then toward Israel, as well by targeting Israeli ships in the Mediterranean Sea. And I believe that the Yemeni army is capable of that, and as well the resistance, and as well I believe that Iran, if they will conduct any attack in response toward Israel, I believe that Israel will actually rethink about what they have done, and they will stop immediately.
All right, we're going to end it there. Thank you very much, Hossein Abokhaiti, activist and political commentator from Sana'a. Sakina Datu, thank you. Journalist, author, and producer from London. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tawai and the team, it's goodbye.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Back to Reality. Well, this is Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be your host in today's episode. And, of course, like always, we have two very dear guests. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Muzaffar, and assalamu alaikum, Sister Nahid.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And as the ritual of this program goes, I would like you to introduce yourself briefly.
First of all, assalamu alaikum to you and all your dear listeners. I'm Nahid. I'm a graduate of TFO, and I've been studying and researching on Muslim issues, and especially Muslim women issues. And I'm so glad and honored to be here with you.
Yeah, so good. And you, brother?
I am Muzaffar Haider from the UK. I've been studying in the Hawza for the past 10 years in the holy city of Qom.
Thank you very much. I wish both of you luck and success. So I'm sure you might have been stuck in situations like this, that you're in a street and then you want to, you're in a hurry actually, and you want to reach somewhere so quickly, but then it's the red light and you cannot cross it, but suddenly you feel like, yes, I have to. And you do it, you cross the borders, you cross the red light, and then what happens is that you will get to the thing you had in your mind, but then there's something behind what you did. Like, if that happens to someone else, imagine another day, you're not in a hurry, and then you all are standing behind those red lights, somebody else does the same thing in front of you. What is going to be your reaction? Sister Nahid, let's start with you.
As human beings, first of all, judging, like, we are built like this, you know, it's in our instinct that when we see someone crossing the red line, when we see someone just committing a crime, the very first moment we start to judge them, like, what a criminal, what a disobedient person to the society.
Exactly.
But what is more important is that these ethical dilemmas are something much bigger. Like, I know that it's okay, we are human beings, it's not okay, but we do it, and it's a mistake that
we
have.
It's pretty natural of human beings to do so.
Yeah, but we normally do, like, in a normal situation, we start judging people, or even some people label them, like, that person is always doing this.
Exactly.
We don't understand the background, or we don't think of the background. Since I've got to work, I've got some hard situations, some time that I had to arrive to work, and I was in this situation, and I felt this, I started to think more, like, consider the situation, the intention of the person, like, I try to sometimes even convince myself in a fake way, like, to stop myself from judging. I started to think this way, like, there may be some problems, you should be considerate, like, you need to think of the other person as well.
Much of evolution, and much of growth, I guess. So, brother, what about you? Have you been stuck in such situations? Like, everything you do, even if it's wrong, it's right, but if another person does it, oh, that's a big crime.
Yeah, I suppose so. I guess that is, as Sister was saying, it's a part of human nature. Yeah. I remember asking my science teacher when we were back in school, we're like, oh, Miss, have you ever run a red light? And she was like, no. She's a really jokey, happy teacher. She was like always making jokes with us and stuff. But when we asked her that, she goes, no, because I had a friend who did that and now she's dead.
Oh.
And we all just went
you an example.
Yeah.
I think that you would never forget.
It must have scarred me for life. But I do understand this concept that sometimes you do need to break the rules.
Yeah.
And I totally agree with that. Sometimes you do. Especially if it's an emergency situation.
It's inevitable, I guess.
You know, a lot of these things you can find in the philosophy of the Salah. And when you're praying Salah, you don't break it for anything. But if somebody's dying, like a child is drowning in front of you or something, it's wajib for you to break your salah and go and save that child.
Yeah, you know? Nice example, yes.
Islam has given us this list of priorities that you need to follow in life.
Mm-hmm. So there are some occasions in life in which I can break the rules, or even I have been recommended to break the rules.
Yeah.
In order to save other people.
The flesh of swine is haram.
Yeah.
If you are on the verge of death, it becomes haram for you to not consume it. In fact, Islam says that even if you are dying, right, when you're dying of hunger, keep yourself alive. Yeah.
The things that we might not usually think of, actually, just as the examples you mentioned. So I guess this was a nice introduction. We'll go for a break and then we'll be back. The thing we mentioned at the very beginning of today's episode psychologically was called the fundamental attributing error. And yes, you're listening to Back to Reality, and we're going to talk more about what we just brought up in today's episode. So we sometimes do wrong things and we don't take it as wrong. Now, what you mentioned, brother, was in occasions where we are forced to do such a stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes it happens that it becomes your habit, like the process of habitualization is going to happen to you. Like, for example, lying is forbidden. You go for lying once and you call it, okay, it was a white lie. I had to do it to protect another person's reputation, whatever reason, because we have brain and this brain is giving us a list of justifications. But then it becomes your habit and you come to the point where you no longer call it breaking the rules, something that should not be done by you.
Yeah, you know what I am going to take issue with in our brother's talk is that when we talk about Islamic cases, in a lot of situations, that thing, that action is just dealing with us. Like if I break the fasting, that effect is on me. Like I am going to face with the thing I have done. I'm going to be able to answer to Allah when it comes to the Day of Judgment. But sometimes wrong is wrong. Like, I have this challenge with myself too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, imagine a person who is stealing food for the family, for his or her own family who are starving.
Mm.
What about this case? Is it okay? We all feel empathy with that person. We feel sad. Like, that mother, that father is just stealing food because his or her own family need to survive. But what if this continues to be a routine? What if this...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
This bad thing continues.
Mm.
In a case that it's not dealing with only us. In that case, we are dealing with ourselves. We are dealing with that supermarket owner.
Mm.
We are dealing with the society, which is a bigger circle. I mean, that crime is expanding and it's hurting the society. But still, it has some logical reasons. I always have this dilemma within myself too. Like, I think of situations, then I come to this result many times that I'm just justifying the situation without understanding that a crime is a total crime. What about these cases?
She's creating too much of difficulties for other people.
See, we're talking about a situation where you know a child is dying of hunger, right? And you need to do something to save that child's life. You would do anything at that. See, when you're in that situation, God forbid that we ever get into that situation, you would do anything. A mother especially, she would do anything to save it. She would kill someone.
Yeah.
Right? So that is a dire situation. And let's argue, for the sake of this argument, that it is justified. Because I don't think anybody has a problem with that situation. Let's come out of that situation. Allah improves their condition. Now they make it a habit of continuously stealing. At this point, it's not justified at all. It's haram. And that's when it's really harming the society.
Mm-hmm.
In my experience, people who commit crimes, like blatant crimes against other people, they're usually doing it out of greed.
Yeah, unfortunately.
You know?
Yes. And it's not the matter of death and life to another person, that they are doing kindness to other person, they're saving another person. No.
Yeah. Honestly, look, if somebody stole food from your house, like let's say that you had a burglary and the only thing that was missing was like a can of beans,
mm-hmm.
would you not just feel really heartbroken? wouldn't you feel really sad? But that doesn't happen. They steal jewelry, they steal big technology, right? It's greed. It's not out of absolute necessity.
Yeah. I must confess that I, you know, we have been reading this play, which was so dark and so exaggerated, and I kept saying to everybody in the class that this is exaggeration, something like this would never happen, like someone eating the flesh of another person. This is unbelievable. What are the number of the occasions and cases that something like this would happen? Of course, in real, ordinary life that we're living, like in civilized cities, I don't think too much.
No, not that much. And that is what makes decision-making based on morality is hard.
It was war, uh-huh. and then the situation got so tough, they were uh-huh. so hungry. It was an Irish war.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Yeah, it was an Irish war. And then I just forgot the background. The only thing I remember is the dark setting and the depressing thing that happened in there. And this was just an example of whatever wrong that happened there. And it was so hard for me to believe that. There are some occasions and some cases in which you go through too much of harsh things and stuff as a human beings. You would not believe that a human would do such a thing. But just as you said, in the very hard situations, maybe we're going to turn into different people.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
As the brother said, what we see in our ordinary life is that they do wrong things, not out of a need to support someone, to help someone, to save them, but just for their own greed.
Yeah, and we're not considering the context many times.
Yeah.
Like, we cannot categorize people like that person is doing this based on the needs, based on reasons, and the other people is just committing a crime. It's not possible for us to
group
people.
But they always say this, but I don't believe in it. See, they come to bring up concepts like there is no such a thing as reality. Reality is the creation of my own mind. But come on.
We do have reality.
Yeah. There is actually a choice in here. You know what's wrong and you know what's right. And it's not the matter of the reality you create for yourself. You know something is wrong and you know something is right. So yeah. You cannot ignore the right thing just because you want to do that wrong thing. So,
I just interject here? When I'm saying that these things are justified, it doesn't mean that they're right or correct.
Yeah,
they're still wrong.
No, you just explained it.
Yeah, when you see other people, that's not something that we should do ourselves. We should try our hardest to be above that.
Yeah.
See, there's a very confusing hadith. You might have heard it from Imam Ali alayhi salam, where he said that if I was told that I would be given all of the riches of this world, right? If I just remove, I would not disobey my Lord for even a moment, even as much as removing a grain from the mouth of an ant.
Yeah.
You've heard this, right?
Yes, of course.
Ya Ali, you could just do that. And then with all of that wealth, you could do something for the sake of all the ants of the world, right?
Yeah.
So it is a big dilemma. And it's about the idea that you would never even commit even the tiniest amount of wrong for whatever price.
Exactly. All that we were talking about was the concept of the fact that doing wrong, even if you do it for a reason, is not going to justify the fact that you have done something wrong. Mm-hmm. And you must think about it so much and do not get habitualized by the wrong things you do just under the pretext that, okay, I had to, my students were waiting for me. There is actually this rule that we're living based on those rules, those set of rules, and we do not have to transgress those rules.
Mm.
And this was all. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Brother, and thank you, sister.
Thank you.
And thank you, dear listeners. Until another session, I just bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
South Korea's progressives extended their majority in the National Assembly in an election largely seen as a repudiation of conservative President Yoon Suk-yeol and his People Power Party. Democratic Party leader Lee Jae-myung promised to work for the greater good.
The ruling and opposition parties must work together to solve livelihood problems. We will spearhead the efforts to overcome the livelihood crisis. I once again express deep gratitude to the South Korean people.
Many South Koreans feel President Yoon has been overstepping his powers with a series of missteps and controversial measures, including the failure to resolve an ongoing doctor's strike.
There were too many cases where this government pushed through policies that made no sense, as if it were a dictatorship.
While the vote revolved around Yoon and the economy, with problems such as a lack of affordable housing and increasing polarization, Yoon's foreign policy latitude will also be curtailed.
This is really bad news for President Yoon. He's going to have an extremely hard time getting anything through the National Assembly. And what's more, it may jeopardize some of his great relations that he's formed with the U.S. and Japan during his presidency.
A new progressive party launched by Cho Guk, a former justice minister, won 12 seats in the assembly, further tipping the scales against President Yoon and his People Power Party.
The two-thirds majority enjoyed by progressives in the assembly will enable them to fast-track legislation and push their liberal agenda. Meanwhile, President Yoon's pro-business reforms stand little chance of becoming law, with Yoon something of a lame duck for the final 3 years of his five-year term. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Eid, but no Eid. Marking the end of the holy month of Ramadan with the same rituals, but definitely not the same festive mood. Iranians observing Eid al-Fitr by taking part in mass prayers as always. Nonetheless, this year, the ongoing genocidal war in Gaza on their minds, and sharing videos of Gaza on an occasion that is one of the most important holidays on the Islamic calendar.
We will always support our brothers and sisters in Palestine. The Zionists should know that they are not alone. All it takes is a word from our leader and we will be ready to fight.
I hope that our presence today sends a strong message that we will always back Palestine.
The Zionists are not human. How can they commit such atrocities while the whole world is watching? The pictures coming out of Gaza and the situation there are shocking.
We will always support the Palestinians. We always have. And today I brought my two daughters as a message to the mothers in Gaza that we will always be there for them no matter what.
This also became the main theme of the leader's Eid al-Fitr address, as he strongly criticized Islamic governments that have not cut ties with and support the Zionist regime.
Eid al-Fitr is supposed to be a happy occasion, but this year Iranians are not happy because of the ongoing genocidal war in Gaza. Yusuf Misha Ahmadi, Tehran.
Italy's Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani has released a new statement following Sunday's drone attack on Russian-held Zaporizhzhia power plant in eastern Ukraine. Tajani said the risk of creating a new Chernobyl must be averted and that a free zone around the nuclear plant must be immediately declared. He also advised against fighting in the vicinity of the nuclear plant. A few days ago, during a celebration for the 75th NATO anniversary, Tajani hinted at the possibility of resuming ties with Russia in the future.
We are not at war with Russia. We criticize Moscow's policies, but we are not at war with the Russian people, and we definitely intend to resume relations with the Russian people.
It is the first time Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, the largest in Europe, has been targeted in military action since November 2022. On Tuesday, Russia blamed Ukraine for launching drone attacks on the plant for a third day, but Ukraine denied an involvement.
The Italian Foreign Ministry's position on the nuclear plant attack is very interesting. Rome, for the first time since the start of the conflict in Ukraine, is not just taking the side of Kiev, but it is pragmatically looking at the interests of the whole of Europe, without focusing on who is to blame for the attack.
Also on Tuesday, the European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell reiterated a warning that the UN's atomic watchdog IAEA issued earlier this week. Borrell said the reckless drone attack in Zaporizhzhia increases the risk of a dangerous nuclear accident. Italy has often reaffirmed its unwavering support for Ukraine, despite Russia's warning against such moves. The Italian government has so far approved 6 military support packages to Kyiv, inclusive of both lethal and non-lethal equipment and specialized military training activities. Max Civili, Rome.
As India prepares to hold the world's largest electoral exercise from April 19,
The main opposition National Congress Party has said the country will lose its secular democratic credentials if the ruling BJP attains power another term, accusing Prime Minister Modi's party of dictatorship. In its election manifesto, the party has promised to boost social spending, saying Modi's ruling party has favored the interests of only the rich. The opposition party promised to uplift the marginalized if it comes to power. Pre-election polls, however, predict Modi sweeping back for a third term. Election results will be declared on June 4th.
Most Indians have realized that only Congress Party can do good for poor and minorities, which is what democracy means. The country is divided today due to politics of division just for votes.
India's main opposition party, which ruled the country for decades, has been struggling to compete with Modi's ruling BJP, which mainly counts on country's largest Hindu majority population for its vote share. The Congress Party, while releasing its election manifesto, has promised more help for the marginalized, including assured jobs for young, improving farmers' income, and better health insurance payouts. The Congress Party accused Modi's BJP of threatening the Constitution.
Our party has been crippled using tax agencies. Is it level playing ground? This is not only Congress Party. They will also do same with media houses. So we need to save democracy and Constitution. We have to unite against autocratic policies of the BJP government.
Accusing Modi's BJP of crippling his party by freezing its bank account in tax dispute, the opposition party manifesto has vowed to undo BJP policies if the party comes to power, promising that all anti-people laws passed by the ruling BJP without proper democratic process will thoroughly be reviewed and changed, including a much-debated electoral bond controversy. The party is sure to address issues related to minorities, communal conflicts, mob lynching and cattle killings, bulldozer politics and suppression of human rights and shrinking dissent. The Congress Party, the main challenger to the BJP, hopes to mount a challenge to Modi's BJP by joining hands with regional parties. The ruling party has, however, downplayed Congress Party's manifesto as a bundle of lies, saying they ruled for 50 years, which is now a divided house of leaders working for personal interests.
In 2014, Modi's ruling BJP gained popularity among India's Hindu majority, promising revolutionary changes in the country, including a crackdown on corruption and economic prosperity. Critics, however, argue another term for the ruling BJP would undermine India's status as a secular democracy, as the ruling party's broader agenda is to transform India into a Hindu supremacist nation. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Highly politicized French polling agencies have rarely dared to make surveys on Palestine, but after 6 months of attempted genocide, a new poll shows public opinion dramatically shifting against Israel. Since October, support for Israel's plan to eliminate Hamas has dropped from 65 to 56%, while condemnation for Israel's war aim has jumped from 35 to 44%. Following the mainstreaming of Islamophobia, France had become an ardently pro-Zionist country. But the polls show that a nation evenly split on support for Palestine isn't far away.
Here in France, we have many stars and actors who are Arabs and Muslims, but who don't say a word about Palestine and who don't support the Palestinian cause openly. It's a shame because they could have a big impact on the French public. Instead, they shut themselves up.
Israel est illégitime.
Israel is illegitimate and has no right to exist. Palestine is unjustly occupied, and I don't see how anyone can fail to see that. I'm waiting for Iran and Hezbollah to do their work and for Israel to get out.
As Palestinians return to the city of Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city, the results of 6 months of war are catastrophic. Israel has killed over 33,000 people and wounded 80,000 others in Gaza, the West Bank, and Lebanon. Famine is affecting half of Gaza's 2.2 million people, while some two-thirds of the nation's buildings have been reduced to rubble.
This war really has to stop. People are forgetting that the Palestinians are humans, just like everyone else. There are just horrible things going on for women and children. And there has to be peace immediately.
After 6 months, the United Nations Human Rights Council finally took a position on the horrific invasion. They called for a halt in all arms sales to Israel and for Israel to be held accountable for possible war crimes and crimes against humanity. Many attribute the Western public's shift against Israel not to the mainstream media or brave politicians, but to the gruesome and heartbreaking images being relayed on social and alternative media. Images of the human costs of the West's support for Tel Aviv have long been censored. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Afghanistan is now battling an invisible foe that threatens its future generations. The World Food Program has sounded the alarm on the rising tide of malnutrition cases, a crisis worsened by the country's ongoing economic challenges and reduced international aid. Marking the World Health Day, the Taliban's Minister of Public Health expresses concern over the malnutrition crisis, calling for international support.
It is clear that Afghanistan is one of the poor countries in the world. There is no doubt that children and mothers are grappling with malnutrition. We need the support of the world in combating the disaster. I call on the UNICEF, WHO and WFP to continue their assistance to our people with poor health conditions, especially those suffering from malnutrition.
The impact of international sanctions and the U.S. policies cannot be overlooked in understanding the gravity of the situation. That is a warning by pediatricians here in Afghanistan. Years of conflict have severely damaged the country's infrastructure, making it a challenge to provide adequate healthcare and nutrition to vulnerable groups. Moreover, recent cuts in international assistance as well as the Western-led sanctions are worsening things.
There are also some foreign factors exacerbating the malnutrition crisis in Afghanistan. Afghan assets that belong to Afghans and are meant to support our economy are frozen. We are witnessing a decline in international health assistance, especially to our children. Some international bodies continue to collaborate, but these are not sufficient. Some organizations that used to support families have ended their missions in Afghanistan.
Lots of people like me are coming to this hospital because their children are malnourished. I think everything boils down to a single problem, economic shortcoming. If our family had enough to eat, our children wouldn't become undernourished. People don't have money and they're not receiving aid anymore.
Experts emphasize that the need for immediate aid cannot be overstated. Afghan families are in desperate need of assistance to combat this malnutrition crisis. The international community must come together to provide the necessary resources and support to save lives and alleviate the suffering of the Afghan people. The economic crisis in Afghanistan is taking a toll on the health and well-being of the war-ravaged nation. Advocates warn that without a significant increase in support, the crisis will further deepen. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Thousands came together for the annual International Quds Day March in the Canadian city of Toronto to show their solidarity with the Palestinian people, especially those in the besieged Gaza Strip. Palestinian solidarity organizations and communities rallied across from the U.S. consulate, calling on Ottawa and Washington to act urgently to end the Israeli terror campaign and genocide and try to save as many lives as possible.
And this year it's especially important because people are motivated to come out in large numbers to bring an end to this genocide that's taking place in Gaza and underline their commitment to see a free Palestine from the river to the sea and a free Al-Quds, a free Jerusalem, free from Zionism and occupation.
Millions around the world are marching yesterday, today and tomorrow, all week. Thousands of cities and towns across the globe are making Al-Quds Day an international day, a call for justice and freedom, particularly for the Palestinian people as they are facing genocide and war crimes in Gaza.
The city has continued its heavy policing of pro-Palestinian demonstrations. Just 1 week ago, several participants were injured and 6 others were arrested in the annual Land Day commemoration by the Toronto police, who were captured on camera using excessive force.
So last week, people must have seen the videos by now, but the police completely attacked a peaceful rally, and there was horses involved, and this is what the police do. They're on the side of the Zionists, they terrorize people. You know, a protest, a simple, peaceful protest, you're not allowed. I mean, this is another example of the Palestine exception. That protest is good, it's a liberal, you know, it's a sign of democracy, except when you're talking about Palestine. Can't do that.
Participants also use Quds Day to condemn a recent deadly attack by the Israeli regime on Iran's consulate building in Syria's capital, Damascus.
Well, Iran has been subjugated to all forms of aggression at the hands of the Zionist regimes and their backers. But the last crime that Israel have done in destroying the Iranian embassy in Damascus, that is a zero tolerance. Iran.